From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the genetic genealogist for PBS's Finding Your Roots series, Cece Moore uses DNA markers to unravel the mysteries of the past for guests of host Henry Louis Gates Jr. Here's musician Questlove.
You just met your third great-grandparents, your great-great-great-grandparents. These are your people. This is your blood.
In Alabama.
Mobile, Alabama. And we're back 200 years.
Oh, wow.
These methods can also identify living people. Maybe you heard about DNA profiles culled from publicly available ancestry websites being used to find and arrest the Golden State Killer for a series of murders dating back to the 1970s and 80s. I reached Cece Moore on Skype. She is also chief of the genetic genealogy unit at Parabon Nano Labs. And I asked her how the work she and her colleagues do could help revive criminal investigations long grown cold.
This isn't like traditional genetic genealogy where you're trying to identify distant ancestors. Instead, you're trying to identify a living person that would carry a specific set of ancestral origins and genetic profile. So how that's done is the DNA is compared to everyone else in the database. And let me mention that law enforcement is only using the public website GEDmatch.
So the Golden State Killer suspect was identified not through Ancestry.com or 23andMe, but GEDmatch.
Yes, and that's a really important distinction that a lot of people are misunderstanding. So I'm glad you said that. It was GEDmatch, which is a publicly available database. They do not test DNA. They're just a repository for DNA files from other companies like Ancestry, like 23andMe, but you have to go through quite a process to download that data and upload it to GEDmatch. So if you tested Ancestry or one of the other companies, your DNA is not going to just end up on GEDmatch. It takes quite a bit of effort. Those companies are opposed to this use, and it is not something that's being done to my knowledge. I know we are only using GEDmatch, and that's true for the other genetic genealogists that I know working on these types of cases.
So they use GEDmatch and they were able to find what?
So the DNA is uploaded to GEDmatch, or I should say the DNA file is uploaded to GEDmatch, and it's compared to everyone else who's already participating in the database, and that's about 1 million people now. Then based on how much DNA is shared with anyone else in the database, you'll get a list of matches. You'll probably have hundreds or thousands of matches, but most of them will be very distant relatives with small amounts of DNA shared. So the ones we need to look at and key in on are the ones that have significant amounts of DNA shared. So if they share about 3% of their DNA, then they're estimated to be about a second cousin. Second cousin would share great grandparents with the subject of the search, so in this case, a suspect. So you need to build that family tree of the person sharing DNA with the subject back to great grandparents. But then to identify the potential suspect, you have to trace that family tree forward in time. And that's where the unknown parentage or adoption methodology comes in. You need to do what's called reverse genealogy, which is not the traditional genetic genealogy that people are doing to identify distant ancestors. So you're looking at the descendants of those great grandparents, looking for someone who's in the right place at the right time, carrying the right mix of DNA to fit that genetic profile of the unknown subject.
It's still a little mysterious to me. They would have to know that they're looking for somebody or have some genetic material to go on, correct?
Right. So the genetic material comes from the crime scene, and it is analyzed in a different way than is traditionally done for law enforcement purposes. Traditionally, they use CODIS, which is just a handful of genetic markers, but the genotyping that we're using that's compatible with GEDmatch tests hundreds of thousands of genetic markers. So it's much more powerful for predicting more distant relationships. In CODIS, they're looking for an exact match, or if they do familial searching, they're looking for a parent child or maybe a full sibling.
Let me just interrupt and say CODIS is the Combined DNA Index System. This is the generic term for the system used by the FBI, correct?
Yes, this is what law enforcement has been traditionally using for their DNA analysis and comparisons. And so they can't predict more distant cousins or relatives from that database. That's the difference with what we're doing. and now being applied to law enforcement. So we can see people that are second, third, fourth, and more distant cousins in the database. For the Golden State Killer case, my understanding is they had a third cousin. So they would have had to go back to second great grandparents of that match, the person sharing DNA with the suspect, and then trace forward. They know that they share common ancestors because they share a significant amount of DNA. So it's just a matter of finding where they share an ancestor, which set of great-great-grandparents, and then tracing that forward and saying, okay, who fits our profile? Who's living in the right area is male, is the right age? And then look at other factors that might make somebody more likely to be the suspect.
You didn't work on the Golden State Killer case, but you did work on a similar case and others, one using DNA to help police identify the accused killer. This was of a young couple in Seattle in 1987. Here's a clip. This is one of the investigators speaking to the CBC News.
He was never on any list that law enforcement had. There was never a tip providing his name until Parabon advised us who he was. And fortunately, the genealogy work was close enough of a match that it led directly to one person.
So Parabon is the company that you work with, Parabon Labs. When would a genetic genealogist enter a criminal investigation?
This is really something that's brand new. It was something that I held off doing until after the Golden State Killer case. I had been approached many times by law enforcement, but had declined to do this work because I had some concerns about informed consent of the GEDmatch database. But after the Golden State Killer case got such wide coverage and GEDmatch changed their terms of service and alerted their users that law enforcement may be using the database or is using the database, I felt much more comfortable moving forward in this work. So it was shortly after the Golden State Killer arrest that Parabon Nanolabs and myself decided to join forces to do this work. So right now, there's no clear path to a genetic genealogist becoming involved in these types of cases. It's only been a couple of months. I think that will become clearer as time goes forward. So in the Snohomish County case that you referred to, the file was uploaded to GEDmatch on a Friday, and I was able to identify the likely suspect over the weekend, and we delivered the name to the department on Monday.
That is pretty amazing results, or quick turnaround. So could Parabon be given DNA from an old blood stain or rape kit? And given that it is old, what kind of accuracy can you make these matches with?
They still seem to be highly accurate. If the file is too degraded, then we probably wouldn't be able to work with it. Parabon is an expert in working with these degraded DNA samples and files, and so we've so far had success.
My guest is Cece Moore. She's chief genetic genealogist at Parabon Nanolabs. That's a DNA technology lab that has worked with law enforcement to help identify suspects and solve crimes. GEDmatch is one thing, but there are voluntarily submitted DNA websites. Ancestry.com comes to mind. So how is using that different from DNA databases used by law enforcement? Do you have to have a warrant, for example, to use this DNA for crime investigation purposes?
Correct, which hasn't happened so far with their autosomal DNA databases. To get into an Ancestry DNA database or 23andMe or any of the big commercial companies, you have to be able to produce saliva or spit in a tube or swab your cheek. And that's not something that can be collected from a crime scene. And so people that still want to participate in genetic testing but don't want their DNA used for law enforcement could still test at those companies. It would be very, very unlikely that their DNA would be used in a law enforcement investigation.
Well, of course, this has been brought up, the concern over privacy, over sharing personal DNA data. And we did reach out to Ancestry.com and got a response from them via email. Protecting our customers' privacy is Ancestry's highest priority, and that starts with the basic belief that customers should always maintain ownership and control over their data. They promise not to share personal information with third parties, including insurers, employers, health providers, external markets without consent. Do you think that most people using sites like Ancestry.com know how their data is being used?
I don't think that most people fully read the consents that they agree to, and I recommend that they do. Now, that said, I don't think that there's anything really scary going on. Like I said, law enforcement is not getting into those databases. If they ever do, it would be through a formal process, a subpoena, a warrant, and so far that hasn't happened. That's not to say it could never happen, but the chances of any one person getting caught up in that are very low. There's a lot of fear-mongering and concern about genetic testing recently, and I think most of it is unfounded. If someone really wants your DNA, be it law enforcement or insurance companies, et cetera, there's other ways that they can get it that are a lot simpler than sending a subpoena to Ancestry.com.
Like what? What would be another way?
Well, law enforcement can follow you and pick up a piece of trash that has your DNA on it. Abandoned DNA is fair game. And so if they really want it, they will do that. An insurance company, well, they do health testing when you sign up for life insurance. So I'm sure they can do genetic testing if they so choose. So if they want your DNA, they'll just ask for it during that process.
Cece, do you think that consulting these kind of public databases is a turning point for crime solving?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've had 4 successful cases announced thus far, and we have quite a few others in the pipeline that will soon be hopefully resulting in arrests and announcements. It is definitely a game changer because this type of DNA analysis is incredibly powerful. I've known this for many years. I've solved thousands and thousands of unknown parentage cases using these same methods and techniques. And law enforcement is just discovering the power of genetic genealogy.
What now, given the technology that we have for understanding DNA and the availability of public DNA databases, what's the possibility of someone just remaining anonymous?
Increasingly small. If you have recent immigrant ancestry, you're much likely to be identified through one of these genetic genealogy databases. There's a reverse bias in them as well as compared to law enforcement databases. So most of the people tested are of European ancestry, Northwest European ancestry specifically. So we're much more likely to identify people with that type of ancestry than minority type ancestries. Now, that's not to say that it's impossible and it will never happen, but it's less likely. And compared to the law enforcement databases, where you're much more likely to get a match to someone of minority ancestry.
Cece Moore, thank you very much for running through that with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cece Moore, she's chief genetic genealogist with Parabon Nano Labs. She's also the chief genealogist for PBS's Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates Jr. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you connected with family members from Ancestry.com or 23andMe? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Or you can post a comment on Facebook or Twitter at OST Talk. Cece may be confident about how DNA is being used by law enforcement. Just ahead, we'll hear some concerns about protecting personal identities. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Atlanta is still on Amazon's shortlist for its second headquarters, or HQ2, but not everyone likes what Amazon is bringing with it. The ACLU and Amazon employees have demanded that the company stop marketing its facial recognition technology to law enforcement. That technology, which Amazon calls Recognition, that's recognition with a K, detects and analyzes not only faces, but objects and entire scenes. The ACLU fears that law enforcement agencies will use this technology to, quote, build a system to automate the identification and tracking of anyone. Ali Breland is a tech and policy reporter who's written a lot about this for The Hill and joining us from on the line from Washington, D.C. Ali, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Ayanna Howard is here in the studio in Atlanta. She chairs the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. Ayanna, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. And good morning.
Well, Ali, I'm going to start with you. Why are Amazon shareholders and employees calling for an end to facial recognition technology being sold to law enforcement?
Yeah, both of these groups have written letters to Amazon, to CEO Jeff Bezos, asking that he drop the software or stop selling it to law enforcement. And the reason that they're doing so is because they're worried about surveillance state creeping too far, and they're specifically worried about certain oppressed groups getting marginalized further by this technology. It's been shown to have certain racial biases that don't serve certain groups well, people of color well, and so they're very worried that it could be misused or just used improperly in ways that hurt those kinds of people.
So are agencies using this technology to build a system to automate tracking someone as charged?
Yeah, so the FBI is using its own facial recognition technologies, working with that. Amazon specifically is contracting its work out to local law enforcement agencies across the country. Orlando had one. They just dropped theirs. Washington County and Oregon is another one. The list is longer, and we don't know the full list, but certainly law enforcement agencies are using it.
Well, so recognition is already being used in Oregon. What are the results there?
So these results haven't been publicly reported yet. It's actually, that's kind of the issue with it, is that there's not really a framework for a sort of transparency mechanism around this where people can go in and kind of like look clearly at what's happening. Through the normal routes, using Freedom of Information Act requests, you can kind of get an idea of what's happening, but there aren't clear reports. People don't fully know what the picture is. And that kind of speaks to the lack of regulation in the space, which is another critique that people have of the technology. And there's not clear regulation of how it can or can't be used and when it's okay.
Ayanna, I want to ask you, how accurate is this technology that's being used so far?
Oh, well, that's the problem. The accuracy is not the same for people of color as it is for the general public in terms of mainstream. And so if you think about this as an issue, it also means that communities that are typically marginalized will be more so because of the software.
Well, let's look at that a little bit. This idea that the recognition is based on a certain standard. Do we have inherent bias in the design of facial recognition software, and how does that work?
100%. So what happens is these software algorithms, they take data from general public. They mine the world. And the problem is twofold. One is that the data that they're mining is very limited. It's the typical user. It might be, you know, highly educated. Economics are put into that, heavy U.S. European-centric, mm-hmm. And therefore they're training on this data set that is not representative of the world. And then I would also talk about the developers. And so the developers, because they also are not representative of the world, don't necessarily see the errors in the algorithms as they are deployed.
So in other words, which populations would be particularly affected by this?
Primarily Caucasian men are the ones that are developing the software, and people of color. They had a recent study that showed women, individuals with pigment in their skin, are the least likely to be recognized by these systems.
Well, we did see in 2015, Google imaging software, its photo service tagged black people as gorillas. So is it that a similar kind of thing?
It is. And the issue is that you want the recognition algorithms to be accurate for everyone. Which is hard. So it's not an easy problem of we're just going to create a data set that just recognizes everyone, because people do have different features, right? So it's not that everyone looks the same. Everyone does look different.
So Ali, how is law enforcement using this now? How easy would it be for a police officer or somebody, an investigator, to know and identify that kind of bias that Ayanna was talking about?
So that's a good question. There's a lot of different parts to it. It's unclear, I guess, to the full extent as to which agencies, law enforcement agencies across the country are using it and how easy it is. But we do know for a fact that some are. Kind of the most clear, transparent case is a case in Florida in regards to a man named Willie Lynch. And the reason that's so transparent is because there's been an entire court case about this. And it's kind of highlighted some of the horror story, the potential horror stories of what can happen. The technology is, I think, pretty heavily established to be not accurate enough, arguably to be used at all, but certainly enough to be not accurate enough to be used on its own. And in this case, it seems as though law enforcement there may have arrested a man simply off this one image that they used they ran through a facial recognition software system. Willie Lynch is a black man. The photo was taken in very shoddy conditions. And so it's a case where the technology is very likely inaccurate already, and it made a situation that was already hard to understand even worse. And it just highlights, I guess, like how the technology can be abused if there aren't proper oversights on it.
What are privacy advocates saying about this, the use of facial recognition technology?
They're very concerned. They're concerned, one, because of the marginalization aspect that we've talked about, but then they're also concerned about the creep of the surveillance state and how much further this can go. China's a very good example of the extent of what can happen if you have completely unrestrained use of facial recognition technology. America generally approaches things differently, but China shows the extremes that can happen. There's talk of testing in China where profiles are created and people are analyzed everywhere that they go across the entire country, and reward systems are set up. So a facial recognition software via a closed caption circuit TV that's monitoring you on the street can tell if you're jaywalking or if you're smoking in a non-smoking area, and you can be penalized accordingly. That's an extreme example, but these things are already starting to play out in parts of the world.
Well, I'm glad you brought up other parts of the world, because there are places, like often the case is made that in the UK, for example, there are surveillance cameras all over the place. You can't go, you know, a block in London without being captured on camera. Is the United States, and we in the United States, particularly concerned about this privacy, whereas others aren't? And either of you can pick that up.
Yeah, I think in the U.S., we have, at least in terms of the public, we have always been more concerned about privacy than, say, other countries. And I think some of this aspect of, even if we retrofitted our entire city with camera systems, we still want the right to give consent. Right? For use of that data. And if it's used positively, it's okay. But if it's used negatively, we want the ability to, you know, delete the data or give consent for your use.
But anything you want to pick up on there, Ali?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that's important to note, too, is that even though a lot of citizens in America are more concerned about these types of things, there isn't clear communication to the poor people are knowing, or these things are known. Houston, for example, is building out its own fairly extensive CCTV network that's in some senses comparable to what's happening in the UK. And it's flown under the radar in a lot of different ways. People aren't aware that facial recognition technology is being tested in that way. And so there's not really a recourse for people to kind of speak out and kind of really know about these things and know what's happening.
I'm speaking with Ali Breland. He's tech and policy reporter for The Hill. And also with us is Ayanna Howard. She's chairman of the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. And we're talking about technology and the law. Used properly is the term that you used, Ayanna. And that's one of the thoughts, that this is a way of solving crimes. This is a way of identifying people. And I'm not just talking about facial recognition, all AI, you know, use of any kind of software that processes language and also tries to figure out how people think. And also the DNA technology that we were speaking with Cece Moore about. If you're not doing anything wrong, what are you afraid of? That's the standard issue. What do you think?
So I think some of the positives, if you think about Amber Alerts, you know, AI could help with that. So a child stolen, if you had the cameras, you could find your child before something happens, right? So that's the positive aspect. So those are the things that we want. But the negative are, you know, I don't want to be tracked. And maybe I'm jaywalking on the campus. I could get a ticket. That's actually a misdemeanor. I shouldn't be worried that that's going to happen.
And for you, Ali, what's the idea? You know, anyone who's ever been arrested, they would be entered into a database for DNA or facial recognition or new immigrants. We can get to that issue later. But after they, that's when they're arrested. If they are not indicted, if they are not convicted, does that DNA get expunged?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a very important point, is that there's not really a legal framework to say that when people are expunged, their faces should be removed from these databases. One of the seminal studies on this perpetual lineup, which was done by Georgetown University Law Center, did propose mock legislation for this and included that in their framework for what legislation should look like, because there's not really any sort of legal there's not a clear set of legal standards that govern how the technology can or can't be used, and kind of laws are being cross-applied that don't exactly work with facial recognition technology. And the other thing, too, that I think is kind of important to highlight, too, is just how easily it can fly under the radar, given that, like DNA, it's a biometric data, but it's considerably easier to track. You can, someone can take a picture of your face without you ever knowing. The same thing goes with DNA, but you know, it's a little more obvious if someone is like swabbing your coffee or following you around. It's, I don't know, it really shows how easily this can be done without people noticing.
What is this perpetual lineup concept that you just brought up?
Yeah, it's the idea that with facial recognition technology, I guess the underlying idea of the very long study is that, you know, we can be seen everywhere now, and you're always under the sort of coded gaze that is lining you up and is putting you in this metaphorical lineup as you move about your life in every sort of aspect of it, which can be the case with facial recognition technology.
Well, and how are algorithms or AI technology, how are they taught to look at us?
So they're taught based on prior knowledge. And so what happens is, if you think even as a child growing up, you learn by looking at faces, and you learn because there's a teacher that says, oh, this is your teacher, and this is your nurse, and this is your doctor. And so these systems learn in the same way. They're collecting data. They're looking at the features. So they look at the eyes and the nose and distance between them. And they come up with a model of what you look like individually. And so then if it sees you again, it looks at their model of you against, you know, a billion other folks to say, okay, who are you and what are these features and how do you match them?
So that is identifying somebody who has a face. But you talked about other data. How about behaviors? What is this concept of predictive policing, and how are algorithms used to create predictions?
Yeah, so things like predictive policing are also based on prior data. So if you look at the crime stats of a certain neighborhood or a certain city, there are hot zones. And so what happens is these systems mine the information with respect to reports where previous crime has happened. And then they determine where it is most likely a crime is going to occur in the future based on this predictive data. And so the problem is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you go someplace, you're going to find something, even if it's a misdemeanor. Well, that's a data point. We're going to put it back into the data system. Oh, my gosh, we had a hotspot. We predicted it very well. Okay, we're going to continue going to that place. And so that's how these predictive policing algorithms on the general level work.
Ali, Time Magazine said predictive policing is one of the best inventions of 2011. That was back then. So what do you think are the pros and cons of this kind of technology and methodology?
I think that, you know, like any technology, the application and how you end up using it is ultimately what determines it. And I think that the problem is that, I guess the systems undergirding the use and the biases that exist in society, the racial biases that do exist, inform how the technology is being used. And so if you make something that is racially biased naturally on its own, which I guess more efficient, then it's going to ramp up the biases. And so that can be the case in predictive policing situations. I think another thing, too, that's important to note beyond these sorts of data sets is the very limitations of the technology themselves. Even if you had a perfect system where there was a very representative pool of people creating this type of technology, facial recognition technology, face rec technology companies I've talked to have said that the other problem that they encounter is that the limitations of the technology don't even account for really dark faces, and it makes the technology really it makes it harder to use on dark faces and makes it less accurate. And so those kinds of things need to be taken into consideration as well, even alongside representation, which is an issue at these types of companies.
So infallibility of technology is one of the things I think that we've looked at, that as a society, we think, well, technology can fix it. But at the other end of this is the law. And the law, do you think the law, the legal system, has caught up with the way that our technology works?
I don't think so. I think that the law traditionally is always much further behind technology. I think that we see that all the time. The Mark Zuckerberg case in Congress is a good example of that. There was just a huge discrepancy in the level of understanding what was going on with technology. And even when you do have a situation where lawmakers, everyone who's sitting down kind of has an idea of what's going on, it's still hard to pass things quickly. Congressional gridlock has made things slower, certainly, the law certainly needs to catch up. I think that a lot of people are in agreement on that, and it's just a matter of getting that done. But there's nothing promising in the future for that yet in the cards.
So, Ayanna, we're up against a break, but any thoughts on that as a person who works in technology?
Yeah, the law is always catching up. And I think one of the issues is that usually a lot of the policymakers don't understand the technology. And so it's hard to create law if you have no idea or you don't understand the ramifications. And so some of it is that as well.
Well, anyone who's over 50 years old can tell you that they may need somebody else to explain some of the technology to us. We're going to keep Ayanna Howard, chairman of the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech, with us, and Ali Breland, he's a tech and policy reporter for The Hill. Up next, we're going to talk more about Amazon's recognition software and the rapidly growing world of AI technology and its relationship to the law. This is On Second Thought from GBB News. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, technology is being used to solve crimes, but we're talking about concerns about who gets tracked and why, and whether our nation's legal system is keeping pace with it. Well, tomorrow, how technology influences our personal behavior, both online and off. And we would love to hear from you. Have you noticed your views changing, even subtly, depending on which sites you visit online? Have you changed your online behavior or habits because of how it affected you? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also answer on Facebook or Twitter or pose your own questions. My guests today are Ali Breland. He's a tech and policy reporter who's written a lot about technology and bias and the law for The Hill. Ayanna Howard is also with us. She's chairman of the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. Now, before the break, we were talking about the implications for everyone of Amazon's facial recognition technology now being used by law enforcement. While there are some worries that the technology is inherently biased, racial justice activists aren't the only people who are worried. In a letter addressed to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, employees of Amazon voiced concerns that the technology could result in mistreatment of refugees and immigrants if used by ICE and immigration enforcement and customs enforcement. So news today, the New York Times and CNN both reporting that DNA testing is now being done on separated migrant children and parents. And given that thousands of children have been separated from parents, most anyone would advocate for uniting them by any means, DNA swabs included. So who's raising concerns? Do you know, Ali?
Yeah, a lot of different people are raising concerns. There's the standard cast of people like the ACLU, civil liberties advocates, academics who are very concerned, who pay attention to these things, lawyers. One of the most interesting people, though, I think, to raise concerns about this is the CEO of Kairos, it's a facial recognition technology company, and he's a black man himself, and he came at this from the perspective that he said that he doesn't believe that this technology should be used by law enforcement yet. He doesn't believe the technology is where it needs to be to not properly avoid discriminating against people of color. He openly acknowledged that he thinks the technology is biased in that way. And so I think that you see on a different level, like there's all the standard people that do oppose this. And on top of that, there's people even within these companies that oppose this specific use of the technology.
Well, let's hear from, this is Brian Brackeen. He's CEO of Kairos, is a Black-owned facial recognition and AI startup, which declined, by the way, to partner with a company that makes body cams for police.
We don't wake up each day trying to make marketers more money. We have committed ourselves to this pursuit because we want to serve our fellow man. We want everything in your life to know who you are, how you feel, and to give you exactly what you need at that time.
Now, wouldn't you look at this, Ayanna, as an opportunity for more representation and design for people of color to be working on something like this?
I think it is an opportunity, but I also... So as technologists, we design things because we do want to have a global impact. Having more representation on the team is only part of the equation, because the fact is that everyone has their own diverse experience. And if we're building, for example, in the U.S., how could we even think about what it's like for a person in India? And what does that look like? So I think it's hard. I mean, we need to have more diverse workforce, but that's not the only answer.
Well, we're, of course, bringing up this idea of AI, technology, data. It's all ones and zeros. So can relying on AI or data also recognize and respect humanity?
Oh, I think so. I think one of the things is I'm a proponent for AI, and I believe AI could be better. It can actually teach us something about our own humanity if we do it right.
Well, how so?
So think about it. A lot of times when we see things that are wrong, it's always after the fact, right? We look back and it's because it's been this accumulation of errors. We're like, oh, that was really bad. An AI system can actually look forward. It could actually project and say, oh, guess what? This is going to be really bad in like 5 years. I think AI systems can do that, whereas we really have a hard time doing that.
So what we're hearing is this mix of a new era of technology will replicate the injustices of the past, because if it's all built by people who look the same, people who don't look the same or like them are possibly going to be targeted or less accurately predicted or understood. But at the same time, technology could challenge the inequalities of the past. How is that happening?
So I think some of the, so for example, with the face recognition, I think now that there's this concern that there is an issue, they're creating ways of doing bias checks. So there's some companies that are creating bias checks. So whenever they come up with a new product, they will have a filter that actually looks to see, does it discriminate against marginalized communities? Things like that. So people are thinking about that.
Ali, what is the research saying about that, about challenging those kind of biases?
Yeah, the research is saying that it certainly should be done, but we're certainly not at a point yet to where we can effectively move forward. It's also showing us that AI is in some ways a really good mirror for how we operate. The biases that get baked in are based off of the biases that we ourselves have. And so even if you do create a situation where you have code that has been parsed out for bias, it's not baked in, you've removed any sort of... coded gaze, which is a term that has been coined to reflect the biases that exist in code when it's created by a homogenized group, in this case, just white men. And it shows us that biases will exist too if we don't address biases and how the technology is used after it's created. And so when it's being used by law enforcement, or there's talk of AI being used in healthcare, if those situations aren't rectified after the fact, even if there aren't biases in the code itself, it will be applied to a biased framework or a biased populace. And it shows us that we need to look kind of generally and look ourselves in the mirror.
Well, Ali, since you're looking at this kind of thing, especially as it relates to how the legislature work, does ICE have access to Amazon's proprietary facial recognition technology?
That's unclear. And these sorts of things, I think, are unclear very intentionally. The network and the way that all these sorts of technologies are used is... people don't kind of want to talk about it because they understand the concern from privacy advocates and how these kinds of issues can be raised. Amazon itself is powering their, it's AWS Web Services help power a lot of technologies that Palantir uses. Palantir is helping ICE with different projects, but a lot of the framework and the legal framework is designed to keep these things kind of in the dark unless people go digging to find them, which is a separate issue that maybe should be addressed.
Well, the issue of children separated from their parents, of course, tugged on so many people's hearts because they were children. Is there any kind of guidance or legal framework for protecting children from their information, both genetic information and images, from being swept up?
Certainly on the facial recognition side, there isn't anything clear on that. And it would be good to have something down. But the perpetual lineup study, which we mentioned earlier, that was done by Georgetown University Law Center researchers on facial recognition technology, really does argue that there is a strong case to be made that legislation needs to exist to make these things very clear. Because this is only the start in a way. Facial recognition technology, we're talking about this, and it is a serious issue that deserves scrutiny. But it's also kind of a canary in the coal mine because this is just the first and most basic or a basic example of how AI is going to be used. People are talking about using automated or AI to like examine healthcare issues and to do a whole slew of different things. And so as this gets more complex, the potential for bias gets extrapolated out and comes more complex and people can be hurt in all these subtle ways that the law and the designers of the technology need to be ready for and need to preemptively handle. Because once the technology's there, it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the bottle retroactively.
But still, a serial killer that had evaded justice for years, caught, kids and parents possibly united. Does the end justify the means?
Well, I mean, we all know that the end doesn't justify the means. And we do make sacrifices because there's an innocent person, that's so much worse than, say, conviction. Even though you want to convict, having an innocent person, having a life of being jailed, for example, or losing their own life, is just so much worse. And so I think some of the laws have to be done and implemented so that we can put bad people in jail, but we can also ensure that innocent people don't go either.
What do you think, Ali? Yeah. Are our fears overblown?
At this point, I don't think so, but it's as Ayanna said, it's very important that we reach a sort of situation where you can have the means justify the ends and create a legal framework where the technology can be used in a just way, where innocent people aren't harmed, where you don't have cases like the one I mentioned in Florida with the man Willie Lynch, who's being tried on a very paltry amount of information, chief among it is facial recognition technology. And actually have these things exist in a way that is beneficial without hurting anyone. And right now, a lot of groups are playing fast and loose with the technology, and it's not clear if people are being protected in the way that they absolutely need to.
That's Ali Breland, tech and policy reporter for The Hill. Ayanna Howard is also with us. She's chairman of the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. Well, we know now, I'm going back to this legal framework, officials cannot tap phones without a warrant. Investigators can't access 23andMe's database, for example, without a warrant. So does a camera recognizing and tagging your face in a database violate the Fourth Amendment? This is against unreasonable search and seizure. Who wants to pick that up? Ayanna's making a little bit of a face.
There's not really a clear precedence. In the case of Willie Lynch, it was done very shrewdly by investigators. It happened during a very low-level drug deal in Florida, and the way they got his face was by taking a picture on their cell phone camera. And it appeared as though a drug deal were happening. And so that might be a case where there is reasonable cause, but as there is not a clear set of legal restrictions or regulations, I think that there's going to be a lot of arguments in court as to what the actual situation is. And then the other situation on consent too, where it gets even murkier that we haven't addressed as much too, is the fact that companies like Facebook have large facial recognition databases. When you agree to their terms of service in 2008, before you kind of even thought about this technology, does that count as consent? I think that there's a lot of legal minefields that are waiting to crop up, and they're already starting to.
Well, Ayanna, this is what you are working with. You know, how do you and your colleagues talk about this in the interactive media design world?
Yeah, so what we look at is how can we ensure, you know, the data's out there, right? We can't put it back in the box, right? Because it's been collected, it's being used, to train these algorithms. And so it's hard to go back and try to remove that. And so we think about it on the algorithm side. Okay, given that the data is there, given that these algorithms are developed, is there a way that we can ensure that they're still have large social impact and don't have bias? So that's the way we look at it, because people are going to use it. So this is the thing. People are going to use these systems because they think that they're good. They think that they're better. They're starting to trust them. And that's the human behavior aspect that we have to deal with.
Well, Georgia Tech, your students who are using Facebook, social media, Snapchat, other kinds of social media, and that facial recognition software, do you think they are as concerned about giving away their right to privacy when they sign up for these social media platforms?
It's only after the fact when they know where the data is going. So during the use of it, during the use of these applications, most individuals, including students, are okay with saying, oh, yeah, sure, you can share as long as, you know, I think that only my friends see it. It's only after the fact that when you find out, oh, my gosh, like this company actually bought my data, that we get upset.
How about for you, Ali? You mentioned Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. We found that some of our most intimate digital details can be given away without our consent. Is this a concern for people who are law-abiding citizens? They may, you know, be doing jello shots, and that might be held against them on a photograph on Facebook. But in general, is this something that people are willing to just live with?
So I think that there's a couple ways to answer that. And the first is, yes, they are willing to, because we've had this situation where people have handed over a lot of this information, these biometrics like facial or their own faces to be analyzed. But I think the second better answer to that is they've handed that information over without kind of fully understanding the implications of what they've done. And I don't know if it's their fault either. I certainly know that when I signed up for Facebook in high school, I wasn't thinking of the impacts of machine learning algorithms going through my Facebook pages and analyzing my face and then using that to build technology. And the other thing too is, you can make certain arguments about how, even if you agree to use these technologies, there's certain things that you have to give up. But companies like Walmart, when you're going through TSA now, they're using facial recognition technology. They're starting to experiment with the idea of that. And that raises a separate set of questions. It becomes essential for you. You know, some people need to go to Walmart to get groceries. If you need to go somewhere when you're flying, you need to go through TSA. And that sets an even darker set of questions up, because you're in a situation where you do need to use these things. And is that actual consent if you have to go in and do that?
Ayanna, what is that? Is this the essential challenge going forward?
I think it's part of it. I think we went, for example, TSA. I'm willing to give my information if it gets me through security in 10 minutes, right? That's something I'm okay with. But then I don't want that same data used in an application that I'm not used to. Say, going by Starbucks and it pinging me with a coupon because it has data about me. I'm like, I don't want to be served an advertisement. And so I think there's this selective, we as people have this selective view of how we want to use technology and the use of our data.
Does that worry you?
I do, because people are fairly, I mean, to model our behavior is not that difficult in certain aspects. And so you can create systems that they'll know how to get you to shop and spend your money, or get you to figure out which school is ideal for your kids just by, you know, hinting at certain times of the day. An AI system can collect that information and provide that. So that stuff worries me. But then there's the good part.
Ayanna Howard, chairman of the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And also Ali Breland, he's tech and policy reporter at The Hill. Ali, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm afraid that's all for our show today. On Second Thought is produced by Summer Evans, by Fenley Foxen, by Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our technical and musical director. Susan Davis is our executive producer. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how technology influences our own view of ourselves and the world. Let us know what you're thinking about at OST Talk on Facebook and on Twitter. You know, Facebook and Twitter. Putting it out there. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of GPB News. Thanks so much for listening.